an error by teams all over the planet. But they must have had something. Primitive myths? Stacks of turtles? Sun gods and chariots? Zamansky laughed.
No turtles or chariots, obviously, but no naive cosmologies. Their earliest language grew out of the things they could easily observe and model. Ecological relationships, population dynamics. When cosmology was beyond their grasp, they didn't even try to tackle it. It was a non-subject.
No creation myths?
No. To the Lambertians, believing any kind of myth, any kind of vague, untestable pseudo-explanation, would have been like suffering hallucinations, seeing mirages, hearing voices. It would have rendered them completely dysfunctional.
Maria cleared her throat.
Then I wonder how they'll react to us.
Durham said, Right now, creators are a non-subject. The Lambertians have no need of that hypothesis. They understand evolution, mutation, natural selection. They've even postulated some kind of macromolecular gene. But the origin of life remains an open question, too difficult to tackle, and it would probably be centuries before they realize that their ultimate ancestor was seeded by hand, if in fact there's any evidence to show that, any logical reason why A. hydrophila couldn't have arisen in some imaginary prebiotic history. But it won't come to that. After a few more decades banging their heads against the problem of the primordial cloud, I think they'll guess what's going on. An idea whose time has come can sweep across the planet in a matter of months, however exotic it might be. These creatures are not traditionalists. And once the theory that their world was made arises in the proper scientific context, it's not going to drive them mad. All Alyssa was saying was that the sort of primitive superstitions which early humans believed in wouldn't have made sense to the early Lambertians. Maria said,
So, we'll wait until creators are no longer a non-subject before we barge in and announce that that's exactly what we are?
Durham replied, Absolutely. We have permission to make contact once the Lambertians have independently postulated our existence, and no sooner. He laughed and added, with evident satisfaction, which we achieved by asking for much more. Maria still felt uneasy, but she didn't want to hold up proceedings while she grappled with the subtleties of Lambertian culture. She said,
All right, cosmology is the trigger. But they're looking for a deeper explanation for their chemistry. Are they having any luck?
Repetto brought back the map of planet Lambert. The markers showing the locations of the teams of theorists were replaced by small bar charts in the same positions.
These are the dance times sustained for various subatomic models, which have been explored over the past 5 years. A few theories are showing some promise, improving slightly with each refinement. Other groups are getting fairly random results. Nobody's come up with anything they'd be capable of communicating over any distance. These dances are too short-lived to be remembered by teams of messengers.
Maria felt her skin crawl again. False messages die en route. There was something chilling about all this efficiency. This ruthless pursuit of the truth. Or maybe it was just a matter of injured pride, treating some of humanity's most hard-won intellectual achievements as virtually self-evident wasn't the most endearing trait an alien species could possess. She said,
So no team is on the verge of discovering the truth?
Repetto shook his head.
Not yet. But the Otherverse rules are the simplest explanation for the 32 atoms, by almost any criterion.
Simplest to us. There's nothing in the Lambertians' environment to make them think in terms of cellular automata.
Zamansky said,
There was nothing in their environment to make them think in terms of atoms.
Well, no, but the ancient Greeks thought of atoms, but they didn't come up with quantum mechanics. Maria couldn't imagine a pre-industrial human inventing the cellular automaton, even as a mathematical abstraction, let alone going on to hypothesize that the universe itself might be one. Clockwork cosmologies had come after physical clocks. Computer cosmologies had come after physical computers. Human history, though, clearly wasn't much of a guide to Lambertian science. They already had their Newtonian clockwork planetary model. They didn't need artifacts to point the way. She said, "This aesthetic, which governs the acceptability of theories, have you been able to map the neural structures involved? Can you reproduce the criteria?" Repetto said,
"Yes, and I think I know what you're going to ask next.
You've devised your own versions of possible Lambertian cellular automaton theories, and you've tested them against the Lambertian aesthetic?" He inclined his head modestly.
"Yes, we don't model whole brains, of course. That would be grossly unethical. But we can run simulations of trial dances with non-conscious Lambertian neural models."
Modeling Lambertians modeling the Autoverse. So how did it go? Repetto was hesitant.
"The results so far are inconclusive. None of the theories I've constructed have worked, but it's a difficult business. It's hard to know whether or not I'm really stating the hypothesis in the way the Lambertians would, or whether I've really captured all the subtleties of the relevant behavior in a non-conscious model."
"But it doesn't look promising?"
"It's inconclusive."
Maria thought it over.
"The Autoverse rules alone won't explain the abundances of the elements, which is the main problem the Lambertians are trying to solve. So what happens if they miss the whole idea of a cellular automaton and come up with a completely different theory? Something utterly misguided, which fits all the data nonetheless. I know they've grasped everything else about their world far more smoothly than humans ever did, but that doesn't make them perfect. And if they have no tradition of giving up on difficult questions by invoking the hand of a creator, they might cobble together something which explains both the primordial cloud and the chemical properties of the elements without coming anywhere near the truth. That's not impossible, is it?"
There was an awkward silence. Maria wondered if she'd committed some terrible faux pas by suggesting that the criteria for contact might never be met, but she could hardly be telling these people anything they hadn't already considered. Then Durham said simply, "No, it's not impossible. So we'll just have to wait and see where the Lambertians' own logic takes them." Chapter 27 Rut City. Pierre felt the change begin and switched off the lathe. He looked around the workshop helplessly, his eyes alighting on object after object which he couldn't imagine living without. The belt sander, the rack full of cutting tools for the lathe, cans of oil, tins of varnish, the pile of freshly cut timber itself. Abandoning these things, or worse, abandoning his love of them, seemed like the definition of extinction. Then he began to perceive the situation differently. He felt himself step back from his life as a carpenter into the larger scheme of things, or non-scheme. The random stuttering from pretext to pretext, which granted his existence its various meanings. His sense of loss became impossible to sustain. His enthusiasm for everything to which he'd been devoted for the past 76 years evaporated like a dream. He was not repelled, or bewildered, by the phase he was leaving behind, but he had no desire to extend or repeat it. His tools, his clothes, the workshop itself, all melted away, leaving behind a featureless gray plain stretching to infinity beneath a dazzling blue sky, sunless but radiant. He waited calmly to discover his new vocation, remembering the last transition and thinking, "These brief moments between are a life in themselves." He imagined picking up the same train of thought and advancing it slightly the next time. Then the empty ground grew a vast room around him, stretching in all directions for hundreds of meters, full of row after row of yellow wooden specimen drawers. A high ceiling with dusty skylights came together above him, completing the scene. He blinked in the gloom. He was wearing heavy black trousers and a waistcoat over a stiff white shirt. His exo-self, having chosen an obsession which would have been meaningless in a world of advanced computers, had dressed him for the part of a Victorian naturalist. The drawers he knew were full of beetles, hundreds of thousands of beetles. He was free now to do nothing with his time but study them, sketch them, annotate them, classify them, specimen by specimen, species by species, decade after decade. The prospect was so blissful that he almost keeled over with joy. As he approached the nearest set of drawers, where a blank legal pad and pencil were already waiting for him, he hesitated and tried to make sense of his feelings. He knew why he was happy here. His exo-self had rewired his brain yet again, as he'd programmed it to do. What more sense did he require? He looked around the musty room, trying to pin down the source of his dissatisfaction. Everything was perfect here and now, but his past was still with him, the gray plane of transition, his decades at the lathe, the times he'd spent with Kate, his previous obsessions. The long-dead David Hawthorne, invincible, clinging to a rock face. None of it bore the slightest connection to his present interests, his present surroundings, but the detail still hovered at the edge of his thoughts. Superfluous, anachronistic distractions. He was dressed for a role, so why not complete the illusion? He'd tinkered with false memories before. Why not construct a virtual past which explained his situation and his enthusiasm for the task ahead in terms which befitted the environment? Why not create a person with no memory of peer, who could truly lose himself in the delights of being unleashed on this priceless collection? He opened a window to his exo-self, and together they began to invent the biography of an entomologist. Pierce stared blankly at the flickering electric lamp in the corner of the room, then marched over to it and read the scrawled note on the table beneath. "Talk to me. Something is wrong." He hesitated, then created a door beside the lamp. Kate stepped through. She was ashen. She said,
"I spend half my life trying to reach you. When is it going to stop?"
Her tone was flat, as if she wanted to be angry but didn't have the strength. Pierre raised a hand to her cheek. She pushed it away. He said, "What's the problem?"
"The problem? You've been missing for 4 weeks."
4 weeks? Pierre almost laughed, but she looked so shaken that he stopped himself. He said, "You know I get caught up in what I'm doing. It's important to me. But I'm sorry if you were worried." She brushed his words aside.
"You were missing. I didn't say you didn't answer my call. The environment we're standing in, and its owner, did not exist."
"Why do you think that?"
"The communication software announced that there was no process accepting data addressed to your personal node. The system lost you."
Pierre was surprised. He hadn't trusted Malcolm Carter to start with, but after all this time it seemed unlikely that there were major problems with the infrastructure he'd woven into the city for them. He said, "Lost track of me, maybe. For how long?"
29 days.
"Has this ever happened before?" Kate laughed bitterly.
"No. What, do you think I would have kept it to myself? I have never come across a basic software failure of any kind until now, and there are automatic logs which confirm that. This is the first time."
Pierce scratched his neck beneath the starched collar. The interruption had left him disoriented. He couldn't remember what he'd been doing when the flashing lamp had caught his attention. His memory needed maintenance. he said. It's worrying, but I don't see what we can do except run some diagnostics, try to pinpoint the problem.
I ran diagnostics while the problem was happening.
And?
There was certainly nothing wrong with the communication software, but none of the systems involved with running you were visible to the diagnostics.
That's impossible.
Did you suspend yourself?
Of course not. And that wouldn't explain anything. Even if I had, the systems responsible for me would still have been active.
So what have you been doing?
Pierre looked around the room, back to where he'd been standing. There was a specimen drawer on one of the desks, and a thick legal pad beside it. He walked up to the desk. Kate followed. He said, "Drawing beetles, apparently." Perhaps 100 pages of the pad had been used and flipped over. An unfinished sketch of one of the specimens was showing. Pierre was certain that he'd never seen it before. Kate picked up the pad and stared at the drawing, then flipped back through the previous pages. She said,
"Why the pseudonym? Aren't the clothes affectation enough?"
"What pseudonym?" She held the pad in front of him and pointed to his signature.
"Sir William Baxter, F.R.S.
Pierce steadied himself against the desk and struggled to fill the gap. He'd been playing some kind of memory game, that much was obvious. But surely he would have set things up so he'd understand what had happened in the end. When Kate made contact, breaking the spell, his exo-self should have granted him a full explanation. He mentally invoked its records. The last event shown was his most recent random transition. Whatever he'd done since, there was no trace of it. He said dully, "The name means nothing to me." Stranger still, the thought of spending 29 days sketching beetles left him cold. Any passion he'd felt for insect taxonomy had vanished along with his memories, as if the whole package had belonged to someone else entirely, who'd now claimed it and departed. Chapter 28. As the city slowly imprinted itself upon her brain, every dazzling sunset leaving its golden afterimage, burning on her non-existent retinas, every journey she made wiring maps of the non-existent streets into her non-existent synapses, Maria felt herself drifting apart from her memories of the old world. The details were as sharp as ever, but her history was losing its potency, its meaning. Having banished the idea of grieving for people who had not died and who had not lost her, all she seemed to have left to feel was nostalgia, and even that was undermined by contradictions. She missed rooms, streets, smells. Sometimes it was so painful it was comical. She lay awake thinking about the shabbiest abandoned buildings of Piermont, or the cardboard stench of ersatz popcorn wafting out of the VR parlors on George Street, and she knew that she could reconstruct her old house, all of its surroundings, all of Sydney and more, in as much detail as she wished. She knew that every last idiot ache she felt for the amputated past could be dealt with in an instant. Understanding exactly how far she could go was more than enough to rid her of any desire to take a single step in that direction. But having chosen to make no effort to relieve the pangs of homesickness, she seemed to have forfeited her right to the emotion. How could she claim to long for something which she could so easily possess while continuing to deny it to herself? So she tried to set the past aside. She studied the Lambertians diligently, preparing for the day when contact would be permitted. She tried to immerse herself in the role of the legendary 18th founder, roused from her millennia of sleep to share the triumphant moment when the people of Elysium would finally come face to face with an alien culture. Lambertian communities, despite some similarities to those of terrestrial social insects, were far more complex and much less hierarchical than the nests of ants or the hives of bees. For a start, all Lambertians were equally fertile. There was no queen, no workers, no drones. The young were conceived in plants at the periphery of the local territory, and upon hatching, usually migrated hundreds of kilometers to become members of distant communities. There they joined teams and learnt their specialty, be it herding, defense against predators, or modeling the formation of planetary systems. Specialization was usually for life, but team members occasionally changed professions if the need arose. Lambertian group behavior had a long evolutionary history, and it remained the driving force in cultural development, because individual Lambertians were physically incapable of inventing, testing, or communicating the models by which the most sophisticated ideas were expressed. An individual could learn enough about a model while taking part in a successful dance to enable it to exchange roles with any other individual the next time the dance was performed, but it could never ponder the implications of the idea itself in solitude. The language of the dance was like human writing, formal logic, mathematical notation, and computing all rolled into one, but the basic skills were innate, not cultural. And it was so successful, and so much in tune with other aspects of their social behavior, that the Lambertians had never had reason to develop a self-contained alternative. Individuals were far from unthinking components, though. They were fully conscious in their own right. Groups performed many roles, but they did not comprise communal minds. The language of sounds, movements, and scents used by individuals was far simpler than the group language of the dance, but it could still express most of the concepts which pre-literate humans had dealt with, intentions, past experience, the lives of others. And individual Lambertians spoke of individual death. They knew that they would die. Maria searched the literature for some clue to the way they dealt with their mortality. Corpses were left where they dropped. There was no ritual to mark the event, and no evidence of anything like grief. There were no clear Lambertian analogues for any of the human emotions, not even physical pain. When injured, they were actually aware of the fact and took steps to minimize damage to themselves, but it was a matter of specific instinctive responses coming into play, rather than the widespread biochemical shifts involved in human mood changes. The Lambertian nervous system was tighter than a human's. There was no flooding of regions of the brain with large doses of endogenous stimulants or depressants. Everything was mediated within the enclosed synapses. No grief, no pain, no happiness? Maria retreated from the question. The Lambertians possessed their own spectrum of thoughts and behavior. Any attempt to render it in human terms would be as false as the colors of the Autoverse atoms themselves. The more she learnt, the more the role she'd played in bringing the Lambertians into existence seemed to recede into insignificance. Fine-tuning their single-celled ancestor had seemed like a matter of the utmost importance at the time, if only for the sake of persuading the skeptics that Autoverse life could flourish. Now, although a few of her biochemical tricks had been conserved over 3 billion years of evolution, it was hard to attribute any real significance to the choices she'd made. Even though the whole Lambertian biosphere might have been transformed beyond recognition if she'd selected a different shape for a single enzyme in A. hydrophila, she couldn't think of the Lambertians as being dependent on her actions. The decisions she'd made controlled what she was witnessing on her terminal, nothing more. Had she made other choices, she would have seen another biosphere, another civilization, but she could not believe that the Lambertians themselves would have failed to have lived the very same lives without her. Somehow, they still would have found a way to assemble themselves from the dust. If that was true, though, if the internal logic of their experience would have been enough to bring them into existence, then there was no reason to believe that they would ever be forced to conclude that their universe required a creator. She tried to reconcile this growing conviction with the contact group's optimism. They'd studied the Lambertians for thousands of years. Who was she to doubt their expertise? Then it occurred to her that Durham and his colleagues might have decided to feign satisfaction with the political restrictions imposed upon them until they knew where she stood on the issue. Until she reached the same conclusions independently? Durham might have guessed that she'd resist being pressured into taking their side. It would be far more diplomatic to leave her to form her own opinions, even applying a little reverse psychology to aim her in the right direction. Or was that sheer paranoia? After 5 days of studying the Lambertians, tracing the history of their increasingly successful attempts to explain their world, and 5 nights trying to convince herself that they'd soon give it all up and recognize their status as artificial life, she could no longer hold the contradictions in her head. She phoned Durham. It was 3 in the morning, but he must have been out of the city. Standard time set a rate, but no diurnal cycle, and behind him was a dazzling sunlit room. She said bluntly,
"I think I'd like to hear the truth now. Why did you wake me?"
He seemed unsurprised by the question, but he replied guardedly, "Why do you think?"
"You want my support for an early expedition to Planet Lambert. You want me to declare with all the dubious authority of the mother of the Lambertians that there's no point waiting for them to invent the idea of us, because we both know it's never going to happen, not until they've seen us with their own eyes."
Durham said, "You're right about the Lambertians, but forget the politics. I woke you because your territory adjoins the region where the Autoverse is run. I want you to let me use it to break through to Planet Lambert." He looked like a child, solemnly confessing some childish crime. "Access through the hub is strictly controlled and visible to everyone. There's plenty of unused space in the 6th public wedge, so I could try to get in from there. But again, it's potentially visible. Your territory is private." Maria felt a surge of anger. She could scarcely believe that she'd ever swallowed the line about being woken to share in the glory of contact, and being used by Durham was no great shock. It was just like old times. But having been resurrected, not for her expertise, not for her status, but so he could dig a tunnel through her backyard. She said bitterly,
"Why do you need to break into the Autoverse? Is there a race going on that nobody's bothered to tell me about? Bored fucking immortals battling it out to make the first unauthorized contact with the Lambertians? Have you turned xenobiology into a new Olympian sport?"
"It's nothing like that."
"No? What then? I'm dying to know."
Maria tried to read his face for what it was worth. He allowed himself to appear ashamed, but he also looked grimly determined, as if he really did believe that he'd had no choice. It hit her suddenly.
"You think there's some kind of risk to Elysium from the Autoverse?"
"Yes."
"I see. So you woke me in time to share the danger. How thoughtful."
"Maria, I'm sorry. If there'd been another way, I would have let you sleep forever." She started laughing and shivering at the same time. Durham placed one palm flat against the screen. She was still angry with him, but she let him reach through the terminal from his daylit room and put his hand on hers. She said,
"Why do you have to act in secret? Can't you persuade the others to agree to stop running the Autoverse? They must realize that it wouldn't harm the Lambertians. It would launch them as surely as it launched Elysium. There's no question of genocide." "All right, it would be a loss to the Autoverse scholars, but how many of those can there be? And what does Planet Lambert mean to the average Elysian? It's just one more kind of entertainment."
"I've already tried to shut it down. I'm authorized to set the running speed relative to standard time, and to freeze the whole Autoverse temporarily, if I see the need to stem the information flow, to let us catch up with rapid developments."
"So what happened? They made you restart it?"
"No. I never managed to freeze it. it can't be done anymore. The clock rate can't be slowed past a certain point. The software ignores the instructions. Nothing happens. Maria felt a deep chill spread out from the base of her spine.
Ignores them how? That's impossible.
It would be impossible if everything was working, so obviously something's failed. The question is, at what level? I can't believe that the control software is suddenly revealing a hidden bug after all this time. If it's not responding the way it should, then the processors running it aren't behaving correctly. So either they've been damaged somehow, or the cellular automaton itself has changed. I think the TVC rules are being undermined, or subsumed into something larger.
Do you have any hard evidence?
No. I've rerun the old validation experiments, the ones I ran during the launch, and they still work, wherever I've tried them. But I can't even instruct the processors running the Autoverse to diagnose themselves, let alone probe what's happening there at the lowest level. I don't even know if the problem is confined to the region, or if it's spreading out slowly, or if it's already happening everywhere, but the effects are too subtle to pick up. You know the only way to validate the rules is with special apparatus. So what do? Disassemble half the processors in Elysium and build test chambers in their place? And even if I could prove that the rules were being broken, how would that help?
Who else knows about this?
Only Repetto and Zemanski. If it became public knowledge, I don't know what would happen. Maria was outraged.
What gives you the right to keep this to yourselves? Some people might panic, but what are you afraid of? Riots? Looting? The more people who know about the problem, the more likely it is that someone will come up with a solution.
Perhaps. Or perhaps the mere fact that more people know would make things worse. Maria absorbed that in silence. The sunlight spilling through the terminal cast radial shadows around her. The room looked like a medieval woodcut of an alchemist discovering the Philosopher's Stone. Durham said, "Do you know why I chose the Autoverse in the first place, instead of real-world physics?
Less computation? Easier to seed with life? My brilliant work with A. Lamberti?"
"No nuclear processes. No explanation for the origins of the elements." I thought, in the unlikely event that the planet yielded intelligent life, they'd still only be able to make sense of themselves on our terms. It all seemed so remote and improbable then. It never occurred to me that they might miss the laws that we know are laws and circumvent the whole problem.
They haven't settled on any kind of theory yet. They might still come up with a cellular automaton model, complete with the need for a creator.
They might. But what if they don't? Maria's throat was dry. The numbing abstractions were losing their hypnotic power. She was beginning to feel all too real, too corporeal, too vulnerable. Good timing. Finally embracing the illusion of possessing solid flesh and blood, just as the foundations of this universe seemed ready to turn to quicksand. She said,
"You tell me. I'm tired of guessing what's going on in your head."
"We can't shut them down. I think that proves that they're already affecting Elysium. If they successfully explain their origins in a way which contradicts the Autoverse rules, then that may distort the TVC rules. Perhaps only in the region where the Autoverse is run, or perhaps everywhere. And if the TVC rules are pulled out from under us..." Maria balked.
"That's like claiming that a VR environment could alter the real-world laws of physics in order to guarantee its own internal consistency. Even with thousands of copies in VR environments, that never happened back on Earth."
"No, but which is most like the real world, Elysium or the Autoverse?" Durham laughed without bitterness. "We're all still patchwork copies. Most of us in private fantasy lands. Our bodies are ad hoc approximations. Our cities are indestructible wallpaper." The laws of physics of all the environments in Elysium contradict each other, and themselves, a billion times a day. Ultimately, yes, everything runs on the TVC processors. It's all consistent with the TVC rules. But level after level is sealed off, made invisible to the next, made irrelevant. On planet Lambert, everything that happens is intimately tied to one set of physical laws, applied uniformly everywhere. And they've had 3 billion years of that. We may not know what the deepest laws are anymore, but every event the Lambertians experience is part of a coherent whole. If there's any conflict between the two versions of reality, we can't rely on our own version taking precedence. Maria couldn't argue for patchwork VR holding up against the deep logic of the Autoverse. She said,
"Then surely the safest thing would be to ensure that there is no conflict. Stop observing the Autoverse. Give up all plans of making contact. Isolate the two explanations. Keep them from clashing."
Durham said flatly, "No. We're already in conflict. Why else can't we shut them down?"
"I don't know."
Maria looked away.
"If the worst comes to the worst, can't we start again? Construct a new Garden of Eden configuration? Launch ourselves again without the Autoverse?"
"If we have to." He added, "If we think we can trust the TVC universe to do everything it's programmed to do, without altering the launch process, fouling it up, or even passing on the modified laws which we think we're escaping." Maria looked out at the city. Buildings were not collapsing. The illusion was not decaying. She said,
"If we can't trust in that, what's left?"
Durham said grimly, "Nothing. If we don't know how this universe works anymore, we're powerless." She pulled her hand free.
"So what do you want to do? You think if you have access to more of the Autoverse than the data channels running out from the hub, you can make the TVC rules apply? One whole face of the pyramid shouting stop to the neighboring processors will carry more weight than the normal chain of command?"
"No, that might be worth trying, but I don't believe it will work."
"Then what?"
Durham leaned forward urgently. "We have to win back the laws. We have to go into the Autoverse and convince the Lambertians to accept our explanation of their history before they have a clear alternative. We have to persuade them that we created them before that's no longer the truth."
Chapter 29. Thomas sat in the garden watching the robots tend the flower beds. Their silver limbs glinted in the sunshine as they reached between the dazzling white blossoms. Every movement they made was precise, economical. There was no faltering, no resting. They did what they had to and moved on. When they were gone, he sat and waited. The grass was soft, the sky was bright, the air was calm. He wasn't fooled. There'd been moments like this before, moments approaching tranquility. They meant nothing, heralded nothing, changed nothing. There'd always be another vision of decay, another nightmare of mutilation, and another return to Hamburg. He scratched the smooth skin of his abdomen. The last number he'd cut had healed long ago. Since then, he'd stabbed his body in 1,000 places, slit his wrists and throat, punctured his lungs, sliced open the femoral artery. Or so he believed. No evidence of the injuries remained. The stillness of the garden began to unnerve him. There was a blankness to the scene he couldn't penetrate, as if he was staring at an incomprehensible diagram or an abstract painting he couldn't quite parse. As he gazed across the lawn, the colors and textures flooding in on him suddenly dissociated completely into meaningless patches of light. Nothing had moved, nothing had changed, but his power to interpret the arrangements of shades and hues had vanished. The garden had ceased to exist. Panicking, Thomas reached blindly for the scar on his forearm. When his fingers made contact, the effect was immediate. the world around him came together again. He sat rigid for a moment, waiting to see what would happen next, but the stretch of dark green in the corner of his eye remained a shadow cast by a fountain. The blue expanse above remained the sky. He curled up on the grass, stroking the dead skin, crooning to himself. He believed he'd once hacked the scar right off. The new wound he'd made had healed without a trace, but the original faint white line had reappeared in its proper place. It was the sole mark of his identity now. His face, when he sought it in the mirrors inside the house, was unrecognizable. His name was a meaningless jumble of sounds. But whenever he began to lose his sense of himself, he only had to touch the scar to recall everything which defined him. He closed his eyes. He danced around the flat with Anna. She stank of alcohol, sweat, and perfume. He was ready to ask her to marry him. He could feel the moment approaching, and he was almost suffocating with fear and hope. He said, "God, you're beautiful. Order my life. I'm nothing without you. Fragments of time, fragments of words, fragments of feelings. Make sense of me. Make me whole." Anna said,
"I'm going to ask you for something I've never asked for before. I've been trying to work up the courage all day."
"You can ask for anything." "Let me understand you. Let me piece you together, hold you together. Let me help you to explain yourself." She said,
"I have a friend, this a lot of cash, almost 200,000 marks. He needs someone who can..."
Thomas stepped back from her, then struck her hard across the face. He felt betrayed, wounded, and ridiculous. She started punching him in the chest and face. He stood there and let her do it for a while, then grabbed both her hands by the wrists. She caught her breath.
"Let go of me."
"I'm sorry."
"Then let go of me."
He didn't. He said, "I'm not a money laundering facility for your friends." She looked at him pityingly.
"Oh, what have I done? Offended your high moral principles? All I did was ask. You might have made yourself useful. Never mind. I should have known it was too much to expect."
He pushed his face close to hers. "Where are you going to be in 10 years' time? In prison? At the bottom of the Elbe?"
"Fuck off."
"Where? Tell me." She said,
"I can think of worse fates. I could end up playing happy families with a middle-aged banker."
Thomas threw her towards the wall. Her feet slipped from under her before she hit it. Her head struck the bricks as she was going down. He crouched beside her, disbelieving. There was a wide gash in the back of her head. She was breathing. He patted her cheeks, then tried to open her eyes. They'd rolled up into her skull. She'd ended up almost sitting on the floor, legs sprawled in front of her, head lolling against the wall. Blood pooled around her. He said,
"Think fast. Think fast."
Time slowed. Every detail in the room clamored for attention. The light from the one dull bulb in the ceiling was almost blinding. Every edge of every shadow was razor sharp. Thomas shifted on the lawn, felt the grass brush against him. It would take so little strength, so little courage, so little love. It was not beyond imagining. Anna's face burned his eyes, sweet and terrible. He had never been so afraid. He knew that if he failed to kill her, he was nothing. No other part of him remained. Only her death made sense of what he'd become. The shame and madness, which were all he had left. To believe that he had saved her life would be to forget himself forever. To die. He forced himself to lie still on the grass. Waves of numbness swept through his body. Shaking, he phoned for an ambulance. His voice surprised him. He sounded calm, in control. Then he knelt beside Anna and slid one hand behind her head. Warm blood trickled down his arm under the sleeve of his shirt. If she lived, he might not go to prison, but the scandal would still destroy him. He cursed himself and put his ear to her mouth. She hadn't stopped breathing. His father would disinherit him. He stared blankly into the future and stroked Anna's cheek. He heard the paramedics on the stairs. The door was locked. He had to get up to let them in. He stood back helplessly as they examined her, then lifted her onto the stretcher. He followed them out through the front door. One of the men locked eyes with him coldly as they maneuvered the stretcher around the landing.
"Pay extra to smack them around, do you?"
Thomas shook his head innocently.
"It's not what it looks like."
Reluctantly, they let him ride in the back. Thomas heard the driver radio the police. He held Anna's hand and gazed down at her. Her fingers were icy, her face was white. The ambulance took a corner. He reached out with his free hand to steady himself. Without looking up, he asked,
"Will she be all right?" "Nobody will know that until she's been x-rayed."
"It was an accident. We were dancing. She slipped."
"Whatever you say."
They sped through the streets, weaving through a universe of neon and headlights rendered silent by the wail of the siren. Thomas kept his eyes on Anna. He held her hand tightly and with all of his being willed her to live. But he resisted the urge to pray.
Chapter 30. The leaders of the contact group assembled in Maria's apartment. They'd barely taken their seats when Durham said,
"I think we should move to my territory before we proceed any further. I'm on the far side of the hub from the Autoverse region, for what that's worth. If distance still means anything, we should at least try to run our models somewhere reliable."
Maria felt sick. The city itself was right beside the Autoverse, the fairground on the edge of the desert. But no Elysians were being computed in that public space, only buildings and puppet pedestrians. She said,
"Six other founders have pyramids adjoining the Autoverse. If you think there's a chance that effects are spilling over the border, can't you find a pretext to get them to move their people as far away as possible? You don't have to spell things out. You don't have to tell them anything that might increase the danger."
Durham said warily, "I've had enough trouble persuading 37 dedicated Autoverse scholars to occupy themselves with projects which will keep them out of our way. If I started suggesting to Elaine Sanderson, Angelo Repetto, and Tetsuo Tsukamoto that they rearrange the geometry of their computing resources, it would take them about 10 seconds to put the entire Autoverse under scrutiny to try to find out what's going on. And the other three pyramids are occupied by hermits who haven't shown themselves since the launch. We couldn't warn them even if we wanted to. The best thing we can do is deal with the problem as quickly and as inconspicuously as possible." Maria glanced at Dominic Repetto, but apparently he was resigned to the need to keep his family in the dark. She said,
"It makes me feel like a coward, fleeing to the opposite side of the universe while we poke the hornet's nest by remote control."
Repetto said dryly,
"Don't worry. For all we know, the TVC geometry might be irrelevant. The logical connection between us and the Autoverse might put us at more risk than the closest physical neighbors."
Maria still chose to do everything manually, via her solid terminal. No interface windows floating in midair. No telepathic links to her exo-self. Zemanski showed her how to run the obscure utility program which would transport her right out of her own territory. The less wealthy copies back on Earth had darted from continent to continent in search of the cheapest kips. But in Elysium, there would never have been a reason for anyone to shift this way before. As she okayed the last query on the terminal, she pictured her model being halted, taken apart, and piped through the hub into Durham's pyramid, no doubt with a billion careful verification steps along the way. But it was impossible to know what even the most stringent error-checking procedures were worth, now that the deepest rules upon which they relied had been called into question. As a final touch, Durham cloned the apartment, and they moved, imperceptibly, to the duplicated version. Maria glanced out the window.
Did you copy the whole city as well?
No, that's the original you're looking at. I've patched in a genuine view. Zemanski created a series of interface windows on the living room wall. One showed the region running the Autoverse, with the triangular face which bordered Maria's own pyramid seen head-on. On top of the software map, the midnight blue of the Autoverse cellular automaton program, finely veined with silver spy software, she overlaid a schematic of the Lambertian planetary system, the orbits weirdly chopped up and rearranged to fit into the five adjacent pyramids. The space being modeled was, on its own terms, a relatively thin disk, only a few 100,000 kilometers thick, but stretching about 50% beyond the orbit of the outermost planet. Most of it was empty, or filled with nothing but light streaming out from the sun, but there were no shortcuts taken. Every cubic kilometer, however featureless, was being modeled right down to the level of Autoverse cells. The profligacy of it was breathtaking. Maria could barely look at the map without trying to think of techniques to approximate the computations going on in all that near vacuum. When she forced herself to stop and accept the thing as it was, she realized that she'd never fully grasped the scale of Elysium before. She'd toured the Lambertian biosphere from the planetary level right down to the molecular, but that was nothing compared to a solar system's worth of subatomic calculations. Durham touched her elbow. I'm going to need your authorization. She went with him to the terminal he'd created for himself in a corner of the room and typed out the code number which had been embedded in her scan file back on Earth. The 99 digits flowed from her fingers effortlessly, as if she'd rehearsed the sequence 1,000 times. The code which would have granted her access to her deceased estate on Earth here unlocked the processors of her pyramid. She said, I really am your accomplice now. Who goes to prison when you commit a crime using my ID? We don't have prisons. So what exactly will the other Elysians do to us when they find out what we've done? Express appropriate gratitude. Zemanski zoomed in on the map to show the individual TVC processors along the border, and then enlarged the view still further to reveal their elaborate structure. It looked like a false-color schematic of an array of three-dimensional microcircuits, but it was too rectilinear, too perfect, to be a micrograph of any real object. The map was largely conjecture now, a simulation guided by limited data flowing in from the grid itself. There were good reasons why it should have been correct, but there could be no watertight evidence that anything they were seeing was actually there. Zemanski manipulated the view until they were peering straight down the middle of the thin layer of transparent null cells, which separated the Autoverse region from Maria's territory, bringing her own processors into sight for the first time. An arrow in a small key diagram above showed the orientation. They were looking straight towards the distant hub. All the processors were structurally identical, but those in the Autoverse were alive with the coded streams of activated states marking data flows, while her own were almost idle. Then Durham plugged her territory into the software he was running, and a wave of data swept out from the hub, looking like something from the Stargate sequence in 2001, as the processors were reprogrammed. The real wave would have passed in a standard time picosecond. The map was smart enough to show the event in slow motion. The reprogrammed processors flickered with data, and then began to sprout construction wires. Every processor in the TVC grid was a von Neumann machine as well as a Turing machine, a universal constructor as well as a universal computer. The only construction task they'd performed in the past had been a one-off act of self-replication, but they still retained the potential to build anything at all, given the appropriate blueprint. The construction wires reached across the gap and touched the surface of the Autoverse processors. Maria held her breath, almost expecting to see a defensive reaction, a counterattack. Durham had analyzed the possibilities in advance. If the TVC rules continued to hold true, any war between these machines would soon reach a perpetual stalemate. They could face each other forever, annihilating each other's weapons as fast as they grew, and no strategy could ever break the deadlock. If the TVC rules failed, though, there was no way of predicting the outcome. There was no detectable counterattack. The construction wires withdrew, leaving behind data links bridging the gap between the pyramids. Since the map was showing the links as intact, the software must have received some evidence that they were actually working. The Autoverse processors were at least reacting as they should to simple tests of the integrity of the connections. Durham said, "Well, that's something. They haven't managed to shut us out completely." Repetto grimaced.
"You make it sound like the Lambertians have taken control of the processors, that they're deciding what's going on here. They don't even know that this level exists."
Durham kept his eyes on the screen. "Of course they don't, but it still feels like we're sneaking up on some kind of sentient adversary. The Lambertians' guardian angels, aware of all the levels, but jealously defending their own people's version of reality." He caught Maria's worried glance and smiled. "Only joking." Maria looked on as Durham and Zemanski ran a series of tests to verify that they really had plugged into the Autoverse region. Everything checked out, but then all the same tests had worked when run through the authorized link down at the hub. The suspect processors were merely acting as messengers, passing data around in a giant loop which confirmed that they could still talk to each other, that the basic structure of the grid hadn't fallen apart. Durham said, "Now we try to stop the clock." He hit a few keys, and Maria watched his commands racing across the links. She thought, "Maybe there was something wrong down at the hub. Maybe this whole crisis is going to turn out to be nothing but a tiny, localized bug. Perfectly explicable. Easily fixed." Durham said, "No luck. I'll try to reduce the rate." Again, the commands were ignored. Next, he increased the Autoverse clock rate by 50%, successfully, then slowed it down in small steps until it was back to the original value. Maria said numbly, "What kind of sense does that make? We can run it as fast as we like, within our capacity to give it computing resources, but if we try to slow it down, we hit a brick wall. That's just perverse." Zemanski said,
"Think of it from the Autoverse point of view. Slowing down the Autoverse is speeding up Elysium. It's as if there's a limit to how fast it can run us, a limit to the computing resources it can spare for us."
Maria blanched. "What are you suggesting? That Elysium is now a computer program being run somewhere in the Autoverse?"
"No, but there's a symmetry to it, a principle of relativity. Elysium was envisioned as a fixed frame of reference, a touchstone of reality, against which the Autoverse could be declared a mere simulation. The truth has turned out to be more subtle. There are no fixed points, no immovable objects, no absolute laws."
Zemanski betrayed no fear, smiling beatifically as she spoke, as if the ideas enchanted her. Maria longed to know whether she was merely concealing her emotions, or whether she had actually chosen a state of tranquility in the face of her world's dethronement. Durham said flatly, "Symmetries were made to be broken, and we still have the edge. We still know far more about Elysium and the Autoverse than the Lambertians do. There's no reason why our version of the truth can't make as much sense to them as it does to us. All we have to do is give them the proper context for their ideas." Repetto had created a puppet team of Lambertians he called Mouthpiece, a swarm of tiny robots resembling Lambertians, capable of functioning in the Autoverse, although ultimately controlled by signals from outside. He'd also created human-shaped telepresence robots for the four of them. With Mouthpiece as translator, they could reveal themselves to the Lambertians and begin the difficult process of establishing contact. What remained to be seen was whether or not the Autoverse would let them in. Szymanski displayed the chosen entry point, a deserted stretch of grassland on one of Planet Lambert's equatorial islands. Repetto had been observing a team of scientists in a nearby community. The range of ideas they were exploring was wider than that of most other teams, and he believed there was a chance that they'd be receptive to Elysian theories. Durham said, "Time to dip a toe in the water." On a second window, he duplicated the grassland scene, then zoomed in at a dizzying rate on a point in midair, until a haze of tumbling molecules appeared, and then individual Autoverse cells. The vacuum between molecules was shown as transparent, but faint lines delineated the lattice. He said, "One red atom, one tiny miracle. Is that too much to ask for?" Maria watched the command stream across the TVC map. Instructions to a single processor to rewrite the data which represented this microscopic portion of the Autoverse. Nothing happened. The vacuum remained vacuum. Durham swore softly. Maria turned to the window. The city was still standing. Elysium was not decaying like a discredited dream. But she felt herself break out in a sweat, felt her body drag her to the edge of panic. She had never really swallowed Durham's claim that there was a danger in sharing their knowledge with the other Elysians, but now she wanted to flee the room herself, hide her face from the evidence, lest she add to the weight of disbelief. Durham tried again, but the Autoverse was holding fast to its laws. Red atoms could not spontaneously appear from nowhere. It would have violated the cellular automaton rules. And if those rules had once been nothing but a few lines of a computer program, a program which could always be halted and rewritten, interrupted and countermanded, subjugated by higher laws, that was no longer true. Szymanski was right. There was no rigid hierarchy of reality and simulation anymore. The chain of cause and effect was a loop now, or a knot of unknown topology. Durham said evenly, "All right, Plan B." He turned to Maria. "Do you remember when we discussed closing off the Autoverse, making it finite but borderless, the surface of a four-dimensional donut?"
"Yes, but it was too small."
She was puzzled by the change of subject, but she welcomed the distraction. Talking about the old days calmed her down slightly.
"Sunlight would have circumnavigated the universe and poured back into the system in a matter of hours. Planet Lambert would have ended up far too hot for far too long. I tried all kinds of tricks to change the thermal equilibrium, but nothing plausible really worked. So I left in the border. Sunlight and the solar wind disappear across it, right out of the model. And all that comes in is..."
She stopped abruptly. She knew what he was going to try next. Durham finished for her. "All that comes in is cold thermal radiation and a small flux of atoms like a random inflow of interstellar gas. A reasonable boundary condition, better than having the system magically embedded in a perfect vacuum, but there's no strict logic to it, no Autoverse-level model of exactly what's supposed to be out there. There could be anything at all." He summoned up a view of the edge of the Autoverse. The atoms drifting in were so sparse that he had to send Maxwell's demon looking for one. The software which faked the presence of a plausible interstellar medium created atoms in a thin layer of cells next to the border. This layer was not subject to the Autoverse rules, or the atoms could not have been created, but its contents affected the neighboring Autoverse cells in the usual way, allowing the tiny hurricanes, which the atoms were to drift, across the border. Durham sent a simple command to the Atom Creation sub-process, an instruction designed to merge with the flow of random requests.